Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
This is an announcement to all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all. With a struggling economy and the cost of living on the rise, Endurance is now offering an affordable, low-cost vehicle coverage plan to the general public. As of today, you could be one of millions of drivers that now may qualify to have your vehicle protected under this coverage and have all future covered auto repairs paid directly to the repair shop for you. You pick your plan, you pick your deductible, you even pick the repair shop. Roadside service, towing, and rental coverage is included. To all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire, get your vehicle protected now and save your wallet from costly vehicle repairs. For your free 5-minute quote and to see if you qualify, visit endurancewarranty.com. Endurancewarranty.com.
Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear Figs. Because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts, and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your Figs? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room listening to this podcast? Wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
All right, welcome back, guys. I'm joined today with the lovely Gemma. And Gemma, who else do we have on today with us?
We have some of our favorite guests. We have Amy and Mike. Mike is our behavior analyst, and Amy is his lovely wife and agent. She arranges the phone calls. And we had so many questions about people's behavior that we thought it would be fun to have Mike come back on and dig a little deeper into that. So welcome, guys.
Welcome. Hi, thank you. Thank you. It's great. Hi, Shane. Hi, Gemma. It's great to be back again. It's been a few years, I think, right?
It has.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember the last time we had a great time. It was really great to talk with you guys about analyzing the keepers and all the timestamps. So we had a great time. And
that was so popular. Everybody loves that you marked the exact times.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It was a good way to do it. You could actually stop the TV and check it out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very enjoyable. We had a good time.
All right, Gemma. Well, we have questions lined up that we've had listeners sent in. So why don't we have you ask the first question? And it can be your own question if you'd rather.
It actually is, because I figured I better give a sample so people would know what we were doing. So my question is kind of general. What are the most common signs that somebody is lying?
Well, the most common signs someone's being deceptive. A lot of the times it can lead off as a stress indicator. And that's like the person's feeling a lot of stress because they don't want to be asked questions in whatever situation it is, an interview, an interrogation, or if you're even having a conversation with someone in everyday life. A person will usually touch their face a lot. The biggest one I would say is avoiding eye contact, looking away, gazing down, looking up to the right. Rubbing your hands together is another one. It's called rubbing and wringing of hands. Fast eye blink rate, increased breathing rate, change in pitch rate and volume of your voice, touching your hair, running your fingers through your hair while speaking, straightening out your shirt while speaking, you know, all stuff like that. So physical gestures, facial flushing, your face turning red like you're embarrassed. Just so many. Fidgeting is another classic one. Fidgeting, shaking your foot when talking to someone. If someone's asking you many questions that you don't enjoy, a lot of people will point their feet towards the exit, meaning they don't want to be there. Place an object between themselves and the interrogator, like all the questioning person, like a laptop or a bag. They'll be hugging a backpack. That's another interesting one. But like I said before in the podcast, you can't help yourself. It's called leakage, and they come out when you're under stress, fear, or deception. And there's so many that we can talk about.
What about, Mike, what about how somebody actually answers the question? Like you said, the pitch and the tone of their voice can change, but are there certain, like the word or are there certain things that people do or say when they're being deceptive?
Yeah, like, most people, I mean, I know I say a lot, and I make little noises when I talk a lot, or I'll say the same little word over and over again. But as far as pitch rate and volume, like, I'll give an example, like in The Keepers, you know, Sharon May. She said at one point, "Photographs? I didn't see no photographs," something like that. And you can hear her voice go up to a point, and then she brings it back down again. You know, it's stuff like that, that inflection of your voice, you know, totally changes when you're giving an answer. And it also helps when there's other cues along with it, like gazing down or looking up to the right.
Mm-hmm. Now I feel paranoid when I'm talking to people. I guess
don't try to stop it, Gemma, because it's going to pop out somewhere else.
Was it hard for you to tell that those of us that were credible were credible? I mean, is it an easy thing to see that somebody's telling the truth?
It is for me. I mean, I've done it for so long. When you're in an interrogation room or an interview room, it's a totally different situation. There's a lot of stress. People, you know, are under a lot of pressure to say the right thing. So being truthful, most people will, you can just tell they're very calm. There might be a few signs of stress, you know, but just because they're nervous, but it's all in context if you're in an interrogation or not.
Mm-hmm. That's a good stage for us, Shane.
Yeah. So, Mike, up until now, you've spoken a lot about the physical signs that you see when someone's being deceptive. I want to ask if there are signs when we are, for example, reading interviews that we would be able to look out for that might be written. Of course, like one of the things that come to my mind is when the journalist went and spoke to Jerry Coob after the allegations came out against him more recently. And Gemma and I weren't there, of course, and I'm assuming that it was not filmed. But is there anything that we can look at in his interview that would be a sign of deception?
Is it a video interview?
I don't believe that they had filmed it.
No, it's an article that ended up in the paper, but it was a very, very long article with a lot of quotes from him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough not to have those, you know, a videotape or any type of recording of either the voice or the person answering the questions. I mean, it's really hard to assess those. So, not so much.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because what I do is it's mostly all visual, you know, it's mostly all visual of all the behaviors and all the indicators that I've talked about. And without that, and if you listen to a voice only, yeah, you can pick up some, like I mentioned, the pitch rate and all that, maybe even a trembling in the voice. But it's really difficult without that physical person in your sight, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. The first question that I saw that someone had submitted was over Coob's behavior, both in The Keepers and now. Of course, because your expertise is with the visual aspects of things, you would probably be able to answer more of the question about Coob's behavior in The Keepers. So I'm wondering if you can combine your knowledge from our past episodes, but also if you've had more ideas or more time to think about Coob's behavior.
Yeah, Coob's, like I said, I think in the podcast, he's an interesting guy. He's very stoic and he doesn't show a lot of expression in his face, at least during The Keepers. You know, he does a lot of, I remember in The Keepers, he does a lot of the verbal message, doesn't match his physical gesture. He'd talk about things like, you know, him and Sister Kathy were soulmates. And while he's shaking his head, no, stuff like that. He does a lot of that stuff. And he has a lot of clusters too when he talks in The Keepers, you know, crossing of arms, touching his face, gazing upwards, and covering his mouth when speaking. These things show that both stress in a few indicators, but when you have these clusters, they're a definite sign of deception. I don't have many new info on his behavior lately, but you know, I really can't compare the two. I've only really seen him on the keepers.
Mike didn't have new information to go on because there is no additional footage for him to observe of Coob other than what was presented in the keepers.
Well, let's stick with him for a little bit because we have a bunch of questions about him.
Okay.
This one is kind of creepy, but this is from, not that this person's creepy, this is from a woman named Kathy. She said when Coob spoke of the body part being shown to him, did he seem legit? Because he swears that it happened, and the police say it didn't, and we all thought it seemed kind of like a performance. But wondering what your reaction was to his demeanor at that time.
I don't believe that for one second. I don't believe that the police would remove a physical part of her body, so to say, from the evidence lab or whatever you want to call it and present it to him. I mean, it could get, even if it was, it could get contaminated, all this stuff. I just don't believe it for a second. He had a look of contempt on his face when he was telling that story too. And I don't believe it for a second. When you think about evidence and how it's treated, I don't think they'd throw this thing wrapped in paper or whatever it was in front of him and say it was, you know, her private body part. You know, I don't believe it for a second. And he just didn't seem to believable at all to me during that whole time in which he described that whole incident.
Right. Well, I did some digging and we know that Kathy's remains were at the medical examiner's office.
Right.
He was interrogated at the police department. So nothing would have been moved from the ME's office to the station. So say a cop was doing it just for shock value to try and get him to say something. I guess I'm thinking more about his demeanor. Do you think he believed it or do you think it was a made up story on his part?
I think in my belief, I think he made it up. I just don't believe what he was saying. I just don't see that happening in an interrogation room, even if it was a good cop, bad cop situation,
right.
Where I just don't see that happening. You know, I've had instances where, hey, we have this file and we have pictures of you doing this. We always kind of slide it towards the person and then back again thinking, no, we're not going to let you see them right now. But highly doubt they would do that, saying it was a body part. It just doesn't make sense.
So, Mike, we know you confront strange people who are being deceptive. What would be the purpose in making up such a bizarre story? Is it to get attention, to be memorable, to have people feel sorry for you?
That's it right there. I think to feel sorry for him. I think that's what he wanted. He's been through such trauma and they did this to me. I can't believe it. This is the girl that I loved and wanted to marry.
Okay. Wow.
So on that same line with Coob, one of the things that always struck me when I watched The Keepers for the first time, and Gemma, I believe you were there for this moment, so maybe you can talk more about what was going on behind cameras. But in the moment when Coob is meeting with Kathy's sister, and he mentions how he will never forgive her family for what they did to him, I thought it was very bizarre that you would try to victimize yourself when talking to someone's sister who was murdered. So, Gemma, you were there for that moment, weren't you?
I was. And we were in a restaurant at an airport hotel. And it was the first time that Coob had seen Kathy's sister since Kathy's death. So when he came in, and Marilyn is very gracious, she got up. I was sitting there at the table. She got up. She embraced him. And the first thing he said to her was, did you bring the ring? It's the very first thing he said. And then shortly after that, he kind of like was sitting in a reflective mood and said, you know, I'll never forgive your family for the way they treated me when Kathy disappeared. Because we have found out since then that the letter that went to Marilyn actually did get into her father's hands. He probably read it. He turned it into the missing person police. And one of the, I don't want to get this too complicated, but one of the survivors who claims allegations of abuse against Coob said that her mom was best friends with Coob growing up. Coob said to her mom that Mr. Sesnick physically went after him when they both got to Baltimore. And we were wondering if it was because of what was in the letter. You know, my supposition was always that Kathy wrote this letter in case something happened to her. And if something happened to her, she would ask Russell to mail it. And that Russ mailed it. It got to Marilyn about a week later. And it may have explained everything.
Right.
And that may have been why he went in, like physically attacked him.
Yeah.
He says, I'll never forgive your family for the way they treated me. I mean, they've just lost their daughter. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, he probably just very, just, you know, wants a lot of sympathy. I just like, there's really nothing for me to go on with that. You know what I mean? I don't have any physical images of them or video of anything like that. So it's really hard. Like I've said, I'm not the psychologist, but in my opinion, the sympathy would be the most thing he was after, I think.
Mm.
Because, yeah, without those visual cues, I just can't make any type of judgment assessment. But what was his demeanor when you were at the apartment visit with Diane?
Ignored her, ignored us.
Yeah.
Would totally focus on what he was looking at, pointing things out to us. Okay. Ryan was over his shoulder videotaping and asking questions. And it was like none of us were even there.
Yeah.
Diane, his wife, stood back and said to me, this is so therapeutic for him.
Yeah, that's really weird.
That, and he had told me, because he was in my car that day, he said to me, I said, when were you here last? He said, well, he didn't answer my question. He said, the only time I was here was when Kathy disappeared. It's the only time I was ever here.
Yeah.
I went back, and in reading the quote love letter that she supposedly wrote him, he outed himself, because I believe he wrote it, and it says something about the last time you were here, as if she's writing it. And I just noticed this like a month ago, and I thought, oh my gosh, that wasn't the only time he was there.
Wow.
Yeah. Very, he knows that I feel this way, so I don't really care if he hears this. Very narcissistic.
Yeah.
And when he is there, he does not like to have anybody challenge him, does not like strong women.
Right.
He was with me, Abby, and his own wife, and we're all very strong women. Didn't like that. He doesn't, he wants to be the center of attention. So he ignores everybody else.
I got to have a follow-up for that, Mike. So when someone is being deceptive, would you often see them trying to make themselves out as the victim?
Oh, most definitely. Yep. Most definitely. They try to deflect that onto themselves and look for that sympathy from people. You know, you could see it a lot on Coop's face in the interview, the way he shakes his head, and he almost gets emotional, it looks like, but he doesn't, because he just doesn't have that in him. You know, he's borderline sociopath. I think he shows no emotion in any of the clips. So I don't know what, he definitely wants to deflect that, what he's putting out as sympathy, you know, onto himself, so people will believe him. That's what I think anyway.
In the interactions I've had with him, like personally, like actually physically there, I have never seen emotion, not once.
No.
For anger or disappointment.
Yeah.
Like putting somebody down, talking about how horrible the church was, to not uncover them. or disappointment in somebody, never any other, like there was never any big laughing or happy or, you know, he was at my home and I went to hug him and he backed off and he said, I already hugged you when I got here. And you know me, I said, well, I'd hugged his wife. And I said, well, it's my house and you're standing on my sidewalk, so I'm going to hug you. And he didn't, I mean, you know, little did I know. Yeah, there's a lot going on with him.
Yeah, there is. Now, Coop, I mean, I just want to kick it back to Coop's wife. When in the Keepers, you know, and this was something I picked up because I was reviewing it again because it's been a few years, like, since we did this. But, you know, when she's at the door or what have you, and she's filling up with tears, and she stated that if Coop was involved in any way, she'd want it brought to light, as she shakes her head no, and then starts crying. You know, that's what's called, it's, now there's a term for this, it's called emotional back pressure. What, that's what she's experiencing at that point. And if, and this is a really hard one to see, and if people listening to this want to check it out, get to that point. I don't have the timestamp again, but when she's talking about if he was involved in this, at the very end of her statement, she has this very slight microfacial of the tightening of the eyes. And if you can see right before she stops talking, her eyes in the corner of the eyes will tighten up. And it's very quick. And, you know, and that's a sign of deception that she knows more than she's saying, you know, that she knows that he had a part of this. And that's where this emotional back pressure is coming from. And it's got to escape somehow through tears, through stress. But this little microfacial of the tightening of the eyelids is what sets it off.
Like a little squint, sort of?
A little squint. And it's so fast, Gemma. You have to, like, look really intense at this, like when she's, the tears are about to come out of her eyes. And if you see on each side of her eyelid, her eyeballs, each corner, the left and right side, you'll see them tighten up for just a second. And that's when she it happens when she finishes talking. And it's something I didn't catch before.
Well,
notice that.
I'm glad you brought it up because that was the next question. So many people asked about Coop's wife being very emotional more than he was. And they want to know, did she seem like she was hiding something?
Right. And
I thought that scene was very telling because if she says we've been together 30 some years and I would want to know. And
right.
Well, I mean, if I were saying that about somebody, I wouldn't be crying.
Right.
What is the reason to cry?
Right. And it's that emotional response that there's so much pressure built up in her that she knows, or he confided in her. And like, it's just a tipping point for her.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like ready to explode. That's why they call it like back pressure.
Did you say back? B-A-C-K? Back pressure?
Yeah, it's back pressure, like built up, backed up, you know.
Okay.
Not in the physical back, no. It's just backed up pressure, like a pipe ready to explode.
Right. This is so revealing. We have another question about Coop.
Okay.
When Coop said Kathy had not told him about the abuse, and that if she had, it would have been a hell of a conversation. Do you remember that part?
I do, yep.
Did he show signs of deception then?
No, no sign really.
Okay.
No. I mean, like I said earlier, he's very stoic. He's very stone-faced. He doesn't show, and as you said too, he doesn't show any emotions. He does flip a few times, you know, with his crossed arms and his gazing upward and his, you know, other indicators he has, but it's not too often. You know, with Coop's behaviors, he's very straightforward and, you know, just a few slip-ups he has that I've seen.
Mike, when you are talking to someone or when you watch a video of someone, if they are a psychopath or a sociopath, is it more difficult for you to spot them being deceptive?
Sociopaths, I would say more than a psychopath. Sociopaths, they tend to not show any emotion or any guilt. And I think with that, they can, I mean, they can't hide these indicators, like I've said before, but they're better at it than most people. A psychopath, I think if you get them to the point of in an interview or an interrogation or questioning them, that they get a little more physical. They get a little more on the edge of being violent, which psychopaths do get violent more than a sociopath. So that's what I think. So I think we did another podcast with you, Shane, about those serial killers in California, was it?
Yeah.
A while back. And they showed a lot of psychopathic behavior in their interviews, like leaning forward, getting up, standing, pacing around, like a caged animal is what it comes down to. Arms crossed with their fists clenched underneath their armpits, you know. They just want to lash out. Coop wasn't like that. You know, Coop, like I said again, he was very, very straight-faced, stone-faced, didn't show much. Sociopaths, they like to manipulate people in different ways. So whether it's people listening to them or people in their presence, they try to manipulate them through different ways.
That's the best definition I've ever heard of those two terms. Because people lump those together. And that's the first time it makes sense to me. A psychopath is like more likely to lose it and be
right.
Right. And a sociopath is more like studied and cautious.
Right. Cautious and calm, actually, too.
I feel like I just learned my ABCs. I'm not kidding.
Oh, good.
I never really understood the difference, but that made a lot of sense.
Well, like I was comparing with Shane about a minute ago about that other podcast we did. I think it was the Speed Freak Killers.
Yes.
That guy, those guys were totally different than anyone you see in this instance with the Keepers. They were total, you know, psychopaths. What more can I say? They were cold-blooded murderers.
Right.
And they showed it in their interviews. The one guy didn't show a lot more than the other guy, but yeah, they were both.
I love hearing the definitions. I mean, I think that it makes it a lot clearer, and you can see what you're talking about with Coop's behavior, that you believe that he is a sociopath.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's very disturbing the way you see the difference in these two type of people, but they both can end up doing the same type of damage.
Yeah.
Whether it's a heinous crime or a crime of passion, whatever.
Well, and I think even in Coop's emails, like when Gemma has emailed him before, it's kind of clear that he has those tendencies. But when you're watching The Keepers, and when we go back to that scene with his wife that you were just referencing, you can see throughout her interviews that she does get very emotional, whereas Coop does not. But what's really interesting to me in that interview is when she says, well, if he did anything, I would want to know. And that surprised me, because if you've been married to someone for that long, you would think that you would be certain that they didn't do something. But instead, she leaves that open for possibility, which was very interesting to me that she would word it that way.
Right.
She also mentioned that she understood abuse because it happened in her family, too. And we heard through the grapevine that one of his daughters may have been, we don't think it was sexually abused, but abused in some way by her dad, whether it was emotional or verbal.
Wow.
So we don't know. And that's their business, you know. And I think you're aware that his wife died. So, and she went quickly. She had cancer. And she was on hospice and it didn't take long. But anyway, do we have any more questions about Coop, Shane?
And also, you know, with his wife, keeping secrets like that are heavy. So maybe she'd want to, or just was on the verge of dumping it. I don't know. That can weigh a lot on you over the years, especially with these allegations.
Right. Yeah, I think that was all for Coop and his wife. But if we move over to Edgar, You know, Edgar is a very interesting person. And
yeah,
one of the comments was that he did appear to be telling the truth, at least in their opinion, when he was answering some of the questions. Now, for all of his interviews, what did you think? Did you feel like he was mostly truthful or?
Edgar was not truthful at all. Okay. There might have been a few statements he made about his ex-wife saying, you know, I forget, something about the fight, and he wanted her to believe he was involved and all this stuff. But I don't, Edgar is, like I said in the podcast, he's definitely in it. What his part was, I don't know, probably will never know, but he was definitely in it along with Scannell. That's my bottom line, in my opinion. The indicators with this guy are just too black and white. They're just there. And anyone who, like, even someone starting out in this field could spot this guy's behaviors. I mean, it's almost ridiculous. Like, it's textbook guilt, innocent, stress, deception, all of them fair. I don't see any truth at all, maybe a few blurbs in his talking, but he's got a lot of clusters. And when you have a lot of clusters with a stress behavior, a deception behavior, and a fear behavior, it's just, there's no turning back. He's involved, no doubt in my mind, in my opinion.
I tried to get more information today for you, Mike, from our director of photography, but he's not available. He didn't get back to me, but he told me that they were there for 3 hours.
That's amazing.
I don't know how many minutes Edgar's, you know, parts of the interview are, but maybe in total, I don't know, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
For them to be there 3 hours. And you had mentioned about fidgeting with the rubber band and asked me if I knew if he was doing that the whole time. If he was, what would that indicate? He was playing.
It'd be great to know that, because fidgeting with that thing the whole time would be a comforting thing. You know, it would comfort him down, but I don't even know if it would have worked with him, because it's an outlet of stress, obviously, to fidget with something, and it calms you down. It's self-soothing. It's like rubbing your hands together and the stuff I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so strong in all his other clusters and his other indicators. It was just amazing to see in someone that does it for a living, you know, and it's just right out there. Sometimes you have to dig and watch an interview over and over again, but to see it that blatant was just crazy.
I've asked about getting the rest of the hours, and our producer just said, Gemma, when we sold the rights to Netflix, they get everything.
Oh yeah.
So,
got a couple guys I worked with, I had them watch it, and they were just amazed at this guy. They're like, he's guilty. He did it. Like, he had a major part in this crime. And they went home and watched Netflix that night and watched The Keepers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just too much. It's just too much to deny it.
In the last couple of weeks, something very odd happened that will give you more food for thought. At the time of Kathy's disappearance and death, Edgar lived about 2 miles away in an apartment with his first wife, and she's the one that was on the episode, but you didn't see her face.
Yeah.
They had neighbors that they were very close to, and the neighbor's last name was Thompson, and the husband's name was Bobby. Bobby Thompson's daughter got in touch with me last week. I've never spoken to her. Bobby Thompson supposedly committed suicide shortly after Kathy's death.
Yeah.
There was duct tape all over the outside of the car. And so that doesn't lend itself to a suicide. But he died of carbon monoxide. And what she told me was that her mom, Bobby's wife, said that on Friday nights, both she and Edgar's wife would take turns sitting in each other's apartments, waiting for Bobby and Edgar to come home. Mm-hmm. And they were always out on Friday nights, getting into fights, getting into trouble.
Yeah.
And this is the first I've heard of this. I don't know if our filmmakers knew this, but the night Kathy disappeared, when Edgar's wife said he came home with blood on him, both men came home with blood on them and no injury.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just Edgar. It was his neighbor.
Okay.
And they both came home that way, but I think they kind of lived rough anyway.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I was rereading the missing person report, and one of the neighbors saw a man in a jacket park Kathy's car oddly and then continue down the street, walking quickly but not running, and making a left. And that would have been the route to Edgar and Bobby's, where they lived.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot that's come out since the series.
I like what you said, walking, I mean, but not running. And
right.
I don't have any other stuff to go by, but that's that right there is called walking with deliberation, but not exactly. running. It's one of our indicators, you know, of someone either being deceptive or someone that is involved in something nefarious. I don't know, but that's amazing that you just said that.
Like it was intentional, but not running.
Right. And not to draw attention to yourself. I'm not running. Oh, we saw this guy running down the street.
Yeah. You know?
But enough, fast enough to get out of there.
Right.
You know,
still can't figure out why they would have parked the car so oddly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They, that's why always, not take a few extra seconds and pull it into a parking space?
Yeah. Like right there. She was right there.
Yep. Yeah.
I don't get that one either. Really strange.
I don't know. Nerves.
Yeah. Who knows?
Okay. We have another one about, let's see. We have other questions about Edgar, Shane. I'm looking to see if we do. Oh, I'm not sure if this is one that would ask you to be too much of a psychologist, Mike, but someone asked, this person's name is Heaven Lee. How about Edgar's ex-wife's belief? I believe her 100%. Just wondered his thoughts on family members' recollections. So I don't know that we even have enough.
Yeah, you're talking about the one they wouldn't show her face, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that Coop's wife, not Edgar's?
No, that was Edgar's wife.
Oh, okay. You're talking about the coffee cup in the.
Yes.
Yeah, it would just show her hands. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, other than that little kind of slight fidgeting with the coffee cup, there was nothing that I could get from that. No, not at all. I hate to disappoint anyone, but yeah, there was nothing to see. Her voice sounded pretty, you know, monotone. There was no inflections. She told a story. I don't know if it's true, but she did. She just told her story. And she was pretty confident in herself, sure of herself and what she was saying. There was no delayed responses. There was no sighs or anything like that. So, yeah, there's nothing I can get from her. And I think she was pretty factual in remembering what happened.
She's a really authentic person.
Yeah.
She told me herself that she firmly believes and has always believed that Edgar was involved.
Yeah. See, and I think through the way she was speaking and stuff, she would have been the type to turn him in if she had the solid evidence.
Right.
You know, that's how she came across to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Just by her voice and seeing her hands.
Speaking more of Edgar, Gemma, when you learned about Edgar over all this time, did you learn that he was a petty criminal?
Oh, wow.
Yes, I did. And the reason I know that is because when when Debbie Yone, who's Edgar's niece, gave Marilyn the necklace, thinking that Kathy had bought it for her, Marilyn actually somehow had a conversation with the police and returned the necklace to the police to return it to Debbie. And I don't know that there was ever an explanation, but the explanation that Marilyn shared with me was that the police knew that Edgar was a petty thief. I don't know how big, how much money petty means, but it was, you know, stealing things. And I've talked to a young woman who actually stole things for him and broke into apartments to get jewelry and watches and cash. I think a lot of it went towards drugs. And, you know, I think he was Maskell's enforcer because we know he worked in a bar on Baltimore's block, which is a lot of strip clubs. And I've talked to a woman who was actually taken there when she was 13. He was a bouncer. Maskell took her into the back alley and there was a room waiting for her. She was drugged and, you know, men had their way with her. So I think he was on the rough side of the tracks.
Yeah.
Not so pop, but
so trucks. A guy that would basically do all this cleanup stuff for like money.
I think he was willing to get dirty and be paid.
Right.
I'm not even sure Maskell was even there that night. He has an alibi that is a good one, but I don't think he would get his hands dirty. He would delegate.
Right.
I think the whole week was planned, actually. The letter, everything. I think the whole week was planned right up until her disappearance because I believe she found out about the allegations against Coop. I think that's what Mary Spence heard in the parking lot that night, that argument, and Kathy would have done the right thing. She was not a wimp. He makes her out to be a wimp. Coop said he was scared she would freeze. No, I had her for a teacher. I knew her for 3 years.
Yeah.
He was very feisty, and he did not like women that told him no.
Right, yeah.
Boy Selecki was the same. She was not a pushover. And I think that was all significant, but I got off topic. Sorry.
That's okay.
You're good.
What else if, right.
I do think it's always interesting that Coob always refers to Kathy and kind of talks down about her in the way that you just mentioned as well, Gemma.
Yeah.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
The fact that he says she would forgive that killed her?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also when he was being interviewed by the journalists here more recently, out of nowhere, he talks about how they had attempted to have sex.
Oh, yeah.
And I just remember thinking, why would you ever in your life mention this? You were not asked about it. Like, it was just a way to embarrass her. It was, in my opinion, you know?
Yep. Irrelevant information or even overly specific. Why would you mention that? There's no point in it. And Gemma, to go back, what were you just saying about she would forgive him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that Coop said that Kathy would forgive the killer, basically, right?
Yeah, he says she would forgive whoever did this.
Yeah, and we went over this before, and that's called the second chance response, right? It's called the second chance response. So a person, Coop's putting himself in Kathy's shoes by saying Kathy would forgive him. This is a deceptive statement for sure. A guilty person or person who knows something will lean towards leniency, you know, or forgiveness to give that person another chance. So Coop's basically saying, I know Kathy would forgive him, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's basically saying, yeah, she would forgive me, I think. And while you're interviewing someone who's saying that, when asked, what do you think the killer should do? Someone who's guilty would say they deserve leniency. Of course, they should be given a second chance. An innocent person would say, if they were in the interview room, what do you think should happen to the killer? The innocent person would say, oh, they should go to prison for life, no parole, maybe even the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Coop's not saying that. He's saying, oh, Kathy would forgive this person.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of bizarre, but it's a second chance response, and it's a known thing.
We're all very frustrated here in Maryland because there are numerous allegations against him now, like more than a few, more than five. They've all been reported to the police. They've all been reported to the attorney general.
Yeah.
And nothing is happening.
Yeah.
And so those women who reported him, who didn't even know each other in three states, they have had it. They're just so frustrated and nothing's happening. And I keep encouraging the detective handling the case to go talk to him.
Yeah.
And he says, I'll go. He's going to go at Thanksgiving. No, I'll go. I don't think they want this solved.
No.
Because
so unfortunate. It's so unfortunate.
It would take down the church probably all the way.
Oh,
to the
sure. Yep. Yep.
And there's politicians connected to this that are still living in Washington.
Yep.
And two police departments.
Yep.
So
yep.
My name doesn't open any doors anymore.
No, right.
So on the same subject, I think that it's probably well in the memory of the police department that there's a huge lawsuit currently against the church that's making them file bankruptcy. So if the accusations are also along the lines of police, that also opens up the door for them. So if they start doing their job and doing the investigation correctly, they're going to find that the police were involved in not only the abuse, but also likely the cover-up of Kathy's murder, which opens up a huge Pandora's box.
I turned in, maybe I shouldn't have done it, but when I had a new detective handling this instead of Robin Teal and Derek Childs, God bless them, but they're retired, a young officer named Josh Battaglia. He seemed very open to my help. I said, I want to look at the files because I can connect these dots for you. And he said, Miss Gemma, it would be fine with me, but the higher ups are saying, if we let you look at it, we have to let everybody look at it. And I disagree with that.
Wow.
Make me think they don't really want it solved.
No.
I offered to come up there, stay in a hotel, be supervised by a detective for 2 days, you know, sign a non-disclosure agreement, and I can give them what they're looking for, but they're not looking. Nobody's working this case. And I probably shouldn't say this much publicly because I've been a target already by a family of a captain that I didn't make friends with in a truck. And, you know, I've moved away from where everybody knew me.
Yeah.
That brings us to Skinnell. This keeps coming up.
Another one of my favorites.
They want to know about, when I spoke to him, the infamous truck segment. What are Mike's impressions in terms of, you already talked about the gesture he made, moving his hands from his shoulders down.
Yeah.
There.
Memory reanimation.
Right. This person said she thinks she remembered him covering his mouth at one stage. I don't remember that.
He was covering his mouth. Yeah, I don't remember that either.
No.
Been confused with Edgar. I don't know.
I don't see where some people have said, and I'm not giving myself credit, that he was terrified of me. I don't see that. I was just being Gemma, like in his face.
Right.
I don't see him. I mean, the deception, I wouldn't have seen it if you hadn't pointed it out, the gesture on the shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. But
were there other things that you saw in him?
Well, yeah. I mean, just his overly specific answers about where they found the body, you know, as stated in the podcast, all he had to say was at a dump, but they found the body at a dump, but what kind of dump? He just kept adding details. It was a place where you can burn stuff. It was a place where you dumped household goods. It was a place for that, for junk. You know, he didn't have to say that. He was just trying to be like, hey, I know I've been there. This is the way it looked. So he didn't have to do that. It's just being overly specific, and he's just trying to be like the authority on it.
So extra information.
Extra information is never good. No.
See, I have found myself doing that. If somebody, I don't know, they said, let's do something this weekend, and I don't really feel like going. I give like too much information about why I can't go.
Deception.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, I have visitors or I don't know. We all do that. It's not important. You just can say yes or no.
Right. You know, and he also, when he was sitting in that SUV, I think when he was talking to you, you know, he had a cold, penetrating gaze in his eyes, which is also a fear cue. Like he was wondering, where's this questioning going to go? Have I said too much? What do they know about me? So he was just wide open, and he's got this blank look, and it's just this cold, penetrating gaze. And he shows that in the SUV when you're talking to him, when he's looking out the window of it, when you're right next to him. It kind of makes your hair stand up on the back of your neck.
And when I'm doing this stuff, I might be a little naive on purpose. It's called sucking up.
Yeah.
And my niece said, if I'm a criminal investigator, I only want to do it with you. She said, but you have to lie sometimes, don't you?
Yeah, right. Another thing, with all his knowledge in police work and crime scenes, it's my belief, my opinion, once again, that he would know if he helped stage that body, Kathy's body, he would know what the other detectives would be looking for. So how to position things, you know, to make it look like she was sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. So I believe, in my opinion, he was definitely involved in staging the crime scene because he knew how to do it. He had whatever, 30 plus years as a detective.
Yeah.
And how much of a coincidence that he was working that Saturday when you stated he never worked on Saturdays.
Yep. They did rotation and there were 8 captains and he just happened to be working. I think they planned to find her that day, but we found the guy that found her very credible.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that you had him on a podcast, didn't you? I believe.
We did.
Yeah.
We did.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, he sounded definitely credible.
We just couldn't. Cops never questioned him since that day.
Right.
Yeah. But Scannell, yeah, I think he's very, when you first came into his house, he was very cold, standoffish. You know, he was doing a lot of soothing gestures, rubbing his arm when he was talking. He was very stressful, didn't like the questions, and he just wanted this to get over with. And he also stayed when
I was
in the interview when he said he was being truthful. I'm being truthful about this, you know, which is a denial flag. And when someone says that I'm being truthful, it's the same as like, hey, I swear on my mother's grave. I swear on a stack of Bibles. I'm being truthful. I didn't do this. I didn't have any part in this. So that's another deceptive cue right there.
God, I would love to do your job with you. I would be such a chatterbox asking you questions.
Yeah,
oh, it's God. It's I think fascinating. It's you fun. Told me about a really interesting book, The Truth About Lying.
Right.
I have that book.
It's great.
Really easy to understand.
Yep.
And it's just really fascinating.
It is a great book.
Yeah.
It's an amazing book and it's an easy read. So if anybody wants to check that out, Truth About Lying, I forget. You remember the author's name?
I don't remember. Yeah. and I don't see it around here right now. I'll post it on the
page. There you go. Yeah. It's definitely a good read for sure.
Yeah. Shane, who else do we have to talk about? Or Mike, did you have anybody you wanted to specifically discuss?
You know, we always have Sharon May, who's another character in the story, but she's, I believe, more on the side of covering up for the Catholic Church than the actual murder of Kathy. You know what I mean? As far as like Edgar and Scannell and all those guys were involved. She's on the other end. But she's very deceptive as well. And she shows a lot of deceptive cues, stress cues, fear cues. She has a lot going on. If you want to watch her on the Keepers, everybody that's listening, you can spot a lot of her stuff. She has a lot of gazing down, looking away, looking to the right. She has a lot of pursed lips, contempt, furrowed brow, answering questions with questions. She's very deceptive. She's got high stress because at one point you can see her carotid artery bulging out of her neck pretty badly when the sun hits it just right.
Wow.
So I believe Sharon May for sure was involved in covering up Maskell and all the wrongdoing that was going on at that time. She's definitely a character. And we went over this, Shane. You remember about her overly specific info about her drive to the cemetery that morning in her convertible.
Definitely.
She's like an actress.
Yeah, exactly.
A role.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think a lot of attorneys, courtroom attorneys, do that anyway.
Yeah.
And you know what she's doing now, right?
No.
She's a public defendant. They're serious.
Oh, really?
Her career.
Wow. And
I know. She didn't have to be in it. She signed. She didn't have to be in it. But I also do know that she had a conversation with Tom Nugent in which she talked to him about one file that was found in the stuff that was dug up from the cemetery. And it was a file of a young man who had been a John Merzbacher, who was also a pedophile teacher in a Catholic school, but he wasn't clergy. And this young man's file was in there.
Wow.
With all the stuff that was dug up, for her to know about that one file, she most certainly went through all that stuff.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and when she was asked by Ryan, you know, about pornographic material being in that hole or whatever, she stated, "I don't recall, and I just don't remember." You know, that's what we call a memory lapse, because they want to avoid answering the question or getting into details. And if you, as a state attorney, are, what was she, attorney general? I don't know, but you'd think she would remember that. That's pretty significant. She doesn't recall or doesn't remember. She says it twice, but in different way.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely a deceptive factor right there for sure. She absolutely knew about it. She just doesn't want to go down that road and get questioned about it.
Or doesn't have the answer, right?
Yeah, like as I said, Ryan did a great job with this whole Netflix thing. But, you know, if he had been trained by law enforcement or anything of how to ask and what to dig deeper, it would have probably gotten more answers out of her. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Well,
but he did a great job. But.
Yeah, no, I agree with what you're saying. And he acknowledges that, too, because for so many of these interviews, Mike, he went into them not knowing what to expect.
Right.
And some of them opened a real hornet's nest, like the vagina comment from Coob.
Yeah.
And actually having access to 3 hours of Edgar's time in his home after, I mean, they figured out his wife's work schedule. They knew he wasn't going to be there. I mean, he had no idea what he was getting into, which
right.
was like entry work.
You know, one of the, you mentioned Edgar again, and one of the things that if someone had been there that was trained in interviewing suspects, you know, there was one point in Edgar's interview with Ryan that he showed the most unbelievable submission cluster is what it's called. He had his hand in the shape of an L up on the side of his face by his ear and down along his jawline while simultaneously stroking his mouth area and his chin area. And they had wide open eyes at, you know, in that point with that cluster, that's called a pre-confession cluster or a submission cluster. And he was ready.
he was ready at that point to give his involvement in the crime, what he did. And it just didn't go further enough to get him to admit anything. And he just stopped. His mind was splitting. He didn't know what to do. And all this leakage was coming out in fear and stress and deception. And you can see it, you know, he thought about confessing, but obviously he didn't, you know, and it was just that much where he was ready to go.
Wow.
He was ready to, if we had seen his chin fall down to his chest and his shoulders just drop, that would have been it.
Really?
Yes. That would have been the end of it. And he would have confessed. If he did those two other things and we had seen it on film, that would have been the end of Edgar. He would have spilled his guts, I think.
Well, you know, he did make a comment about, I can't remember what the question was, but he said something about he was young and stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of, you know, kind of saying, you know, yeah, I made mistakes.
Yeah, I just, you know, way back when we first did this and I got involved with you guys and watching The Keepers, I just wanted to, like, reach my hands through the TV and go, ask them more questions.
Uh-huh.
Ask him more questions, you know,
right.
but he just shut down, and I don't know what happened after the cameras went off, but very interesting.
Oh,
but he's gone now, so.
And, you know, they wouldn't have known what you're describing
unless right.
they're trained to look for it.
Exactly.
Like, and he made an L, like the letter L.
So, yeah, you take, say your thumb. Your thumb and your index finger is up by your ear. Your index finger is down by your ear. And your thumb is massaging your jawline and the knob of your chin.
Uh-huh.
So those three together, and the gazing down, the stroking of the mouth area, definitely pre-confession submission cluster. And he was ready to go. And that could have opened up the whole thing, you know.
See, and I don't think police officers are trained in analysis of deception well enough. Maybe some detectives are, but I just think everything that we've shared is so significant and so important, and yet they're not taking advantage of it
because
they just don't see it. Yeah. I don't know if I have any other questions. Mike, is there anybody you want to talk about?
No, I was just wondering, like, has Coop, Gemma's kind of a question for you. Has Coop ever asked you about Kathy as a person who knew her to, like, reminisce or bring up any old memories?
Never.
Never? Wow.
People have, because I have fond memories.
Yeah.
We've never had, like, casual give and take conversations.
Yeah. About
her. I was fooled for a while, and I have to hand it to Abby. She sensed something was wrong as soon as we met him.
Yeah.
And it was my home, and I was being like Miss Hostess. And it was when he first came in, I had nothing to lose right now. When he first came in, Abby brought food. And as soon as he came in, he pulled a chair up. He started eating.
Yeah.
And nobody else was, like, sitting down at the table. And he said, so why are we doing this today? And I said, well, we were hoping you could shed some light on, you know, the apartment complex. And you wanted to go where Kathy was found. And he said, I don't think so. And I was
so
like,
he was a little reluctant then?
Yeah, and then Ryan said, well, it would be really, really mean a lot to me if you would just, you know, I know it's going to be hard, but if you would just share with us, narrate for us what you remember. And yeah. So Ryan did lots of stroking. I was just being me, kind of in his face and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, juggle everybody. And so he rode with me in the car, which now really gives me the creeps, but that's okay. Right?
Was there any conversation in the car, small talk or anything?
John, our cameraman was in the back seat.
Oh, okay.
I know, we forget that it was videotaped by somebody sitting there, right?
Right, right.
Like, people tell me, why did you go to the bar at the beginning by yourself?
Yeah.
And I'm, wait a minute, it wasn't by myself. There was like three people with me. They want to know, why was I in a bar by myself hitting up the owner? But anyway, documentaries are just so fascinating the way they're made.
Right.
You don't know what's going to happen.
No.
So, now, Ryan did a lot of stroking and lots of questions, and we all just held back a little bit. But he did say to me it was the only time that he had ever been there was the night Kathy disappeared. And we know that's not true.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Are there any plans in the works for a FIPA sequel?
I don't know anything about that.
Oh, okay. Just wondering.
They've moved on to so many other amazing projects. I don't know if you've seen any of their other documentaries. The one they just released called Into the Fire.
No.
Oh, my God. I think it's as good as or better than The Keepers. And it's about a woman who gave up her daughter. I'll plug it so people listening can watch it. She gave up her daughter for adoption because she was very young when she had her daughter. And years later, she learns that the girl is missing. And so she decides she's going to go find her daughter.
Yeah.
So the girl went missing like at 12.
Oh,
and
wow.
And so she finds the people that adopted her daughter. And it's just two episodes. They're each about 70 minutes long. They're each a full story in themselves. But she is a badass. And I say I was rooting her on. And we've become friends. And she's a very cool lady. And the story is amazing because that in order to find her, I have to walk through fire, and that's what I'm going to do.
That sounds interesting. We're going to have to check it out.
Oh, you'll like it. It's just two episodes. You and Amy will appreciate it.
I just wanted to say one more thing about Coop at that gathering you had in the hotel restaurant when he got a hold of a ring. You know, it was kind of an eerie feeling, not so much any deceptive indicators, but a kind of a just an odd reaction to it, you know, and there's a reason behind it. So I'll just try to explain what he saw. So he took the ring and he smiles when he takes it from Marilyn, right?
Mm-hmm.
He gives this far-off look in his face like he's living in the past. And there is a time, these are the times when people are involved in a crime and murders who get a piece of evidence or a personal belonging of a victim. It makes them happy and it gives them a sense of elation or joy. And they start thinking about the past. This is what happens to Coop. He gets this eerie, sheepish grin on his face as he's looking at the ring in his fingers. And it's just kind of unnerving to see that, if anybody wants to watch that exchange.
And we've had viewers comment, it's almost like he's salivating over it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a very odd. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm going to say here for the first time publicly, I heard him tell his wife to shut up.
Oh, yeah.
She made a comment and he told her to shut up.
Yep.
And I almost said something. You know me, I'm like a lioness if somebody does something to somebody else. And
right.
John grabs
thumbs. And I noticed that he had a look of contempt while she was talking.
Mm-hmm.
His mouth was turned down. He's squinting and glaring at her as if he wanted her to stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically saying, all right, but what you said, you know, shut up, but with his.
Right. John Benham was the photographer, was sitting next to me. He took my arm and held me back. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, I would be getting a lot of trouble if I was in law enforcement.
Can you imagine someone telling Jim to shut up?
Yeah. I can imagine telling my wife to shut up. She'd commit a homicide.
Right.
That's why Amy and I get along.
That's right. You do.
Amy's her own person.
She is. She is.
You know
She's
what
pretty.
I'm saying. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Couples, and my husband and I were the same way. We compliment each other.
You do. You do. And she'll, you know, I tend to hold back sometimes and she'll push me to get things done. I'm not lazy by any means, but like I tend to procrastinate. I will say that. And she'll have that
pull in my back, pushing me, come on, get it done.
And but, you and Amy very much remind me of my husband and I.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, he was very, well, he was an artist and a handyman, but he was less, like, the bills would pile up if I didn't say, like, yeah, I need to deal with this right here.
Yeah, and yeah.
I had to, you know, he slowed me down when I needed to.
Yeah.
Soften the edges. And yeah. I asked him to, you know, go back to school and to pursue his art career. And unfortunately, it didn't work out, but it was a good match. And I think that's the way you two are.
Yeah, it is. We're a good match and we lean on each other a lot.
I know. You're very lucky, both of you.
There are two things that we talked about that I wanted to touch just real quick as we kind of wrap up here. One of them is we've been talking about Coob, I feel like, for most of the conversation. But one of the things that's always struck me as interesting with Coob is that he always seems to want to know what you know. So if Gemma would email him, he would refuse to come on the podcast, but he still would keep that communication going to kind of see what she knows. And you can really see that when the journalists show up to his house randomly, unannounced.
Yeah.
And instead of, I feel like the normal behavior, if someone were to show up at my house and accuse me of doing something that I didn't do, I would tell them to go away. But instead, he invites them in, and his excuse isn't that he doesn't believe these women or anything like that. It is that there's another Jerry Coob, someone else with his full name, and that's who they're confusing him with, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't. There was a Coop, K-U-P-F, and a Gerhardt Coob, but no other Jerry Coob. And he said the women, I'll send you that article, Mike, because I don't think you've read it, but he said the women who accused him of abuse wrote letters to him, and he had the letters. He had the emails and the letters and showed them. He held them out to the reporters, but wouldn't let them read them. But he said, I don't want you to read them because they're disgusting. But he kept them.
Yeah.
And how silly is it that survivors would misremember who the person who victimized them is? Like, I have never would I think, okay, this person's name is somewhat familiar or the same. So I bet that, you know, they're the ones who abused me. No, you don't remember someone's name necessarily. You remember what they look like and those type of details. So the idea that you could confuse me because someone shared a similar name as me was nonsense to me. But we also have spoken about May, and it was really interesting to me, and you kind of referenced this, Mike, when May is remembering all of those details, she seems to remember them with the high ability of remembering all those details. I mean, she talks about the Mustang, or was it a Mustang? Right. It was a brand new car that she drove,
right?
The convertible. And any other question you asked, she knew the answer to. You know, she just remembered it very clearly. But the moment that you bring up pornography in the whole, I don't remember that, you know? Yeah. And I just thought that was really interesting that you would remember every specific detail down to the drive to get there. Oh, but this damning detail, I don't remember that, to be honest with you.
And even describing the evidence, and they were wet and they were soggy, they had to be sorted. You know, she remembered all that, but she doesn't remember any of the contents.
This is exactly what happened with Coob. He doesn't recall whether they drove the route Kathy would have taken, okay? But he remembers that they were sitting in his office drinking Tia Maria.
Tia Maria, chocolate liqueur,
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and like, remember when Coob said, when he was talking, I forget the context, but asked about Pete McKeon, and he was like, do you know something about it? You know, he wanted to know, get some more information from you guys. What do you know that I don't know about Pete? Right. What did he say?
Right. I asked him if he had spoken to Pete. He said, I don't even know if he's alive.
Yeah.
And a week later, I can't remember what the setting was, but he shared with me that he had called Pete and that Pete's wife said he was too ill to, and this was more recently, to come to the phone.
Yeah.
And probably so relieved because right. then died.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I can't remember. I think maybe Tube had something on him, something small.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't a priest yet. He was a brother. He could have been dating, but he somehow got him to go along with his story.
Yep.
And I don't believe anything Coop says about that night. None of it. It doesn't missing
and,
birth.
And again, you know, thinking about those irrelevant details and always being, why would you have to mention that they had some chocolate liqueur, Tia Marie?
Right.
Why, and then he chuckles.
Yeah,
you know, he chuckles after he says it, like, "Oh, it was such a great night." Like, not even relevant to what is being asked or said. It just didn't make sense. But again, deceptive. You know, deceptive cue right there.
What do you make of him saying he fell to the ground when he heard Kathy was found because he was relieved? He says he was standing against the wall when he heard she was found. And he slid down and sat on the floor with relief.
Well, again, with Coop, we know kind of his, I'm not going to say his sympathy cues. That could have been another overly dramatic gesture of him to have people feel bad for him. Sympathy. He seems to have a lot of that to take away any questioning. Oh, I feel bad for him. He went through a lot, you know. He wanted to marry this girl, so I can understand why he's so upset. Like I said in the beginning, he's a tough one, but definitely has those deceptive cues. Whether he comes forward one day because the end is near, I don't know, but we'll never know until he does.
Yeah, I don't think he will.
No, he probably won't.
Well, I think they're waiting for him to die.
Probably.
For some reason, they're protecting him. I don't know why.
All right. So we can end with this, but one scene from The Keepers that always sticks in my head, and we were just talking about this a moment ago, is when Sharon May talks about her driving in that new red convertible. And that's a scene that always replays in my head for some reason. And now I just can't help but wonder if that was a new gift from the Archdiocese of Baltimore on her way to see this hole, which could have been enough information to tear down the entire church. So it just, that thought has always stuck with me. Like, I wonder where she got that brand new red convertible. Like, what are, it's just a huge coincidence that she's on her way to this hole that could bring down this entire ring. It could bring down the church, but she just has this brand new red convertible. That's always bothered me so much.
And it wasn't like they, you know, with Charles France, they offered him a boat. What do you want, a boat?
You know,
it wasn't beyond their scope, for sure.
That's a great point. Yeah, as you mentioned, they offered him a literal boat. So I'm sure they could have approached her and been like, hey, you know, that Buick out there, we could replace that with your dream car.
And, you know, I think one of the, someone mentioned him, you know, he was just a victim of this whole thing. And this guy just wanted justice, just wanted them to admit what they'd done, and they won't. And he just had the deepest, saddest look, countenance on his face during The Keepers. Nothing about that guy was any kind of deception, any kind of anything but sorrow.
Right.
You know, but I felt really bad for that guy.
Yeah. Well, right now he's doing okay.
Oh, that's good.
There were some setbacks for him when the series came out.
Yeah.
And we were asked to all just leave him alone, but he's doing okay. He has a good woman in his life, and his family is growing. And
great.
We've been in touch, and he seems like he's doing fine now. I did want to add, I don't know if you knew that Sharon May's husband was a Baltimore City police officer.
Right.
And, you know, who knows? Who knows?
Was he involved with any of the case at all?
We don't know.
Okay.
Mike, thank you so much for this lightning experience.